Hello, and welcome to a very special version of the Race Formula E podcast. Today, we will be looking at a very select group of people who operate within the world of the ABB FIA Formula E Championship. These are the true influencers, the movers and shakers, those who have achieved a level of technical excellence that is truly inspiring. Welcome to the Formula E Power List, presented by Neon. Joining me, Andrew Vandenberg, to talk through the 25 power brokers is the Race Formula E correspondent, Sam Smith, the man who has painstakingly researched and assembled this list and the supporting content that will be released on the race channels over the next 10 days. Defining power, especially in terms of how it's wielded and implemented in a sport such as Formula E, could be considered a nebulous concept. So Sam, to kick us off, can you explain what we mean by power in this context?
I think for the purposes of this list, we were really looking at influential power. So that is to say individuals that have a potent ability to make a difference in Formula E, either by being key decision makers or, I guess, persons that can affect change with the power they have. We also wanted to get a good spread throughout the organisational, the sporting, the technical, the media, the business commercial side of things also. But there are also key strands within Formula E, like sustainability, of course, which has to be factored in and which features also in some supplementary material and content that we'll be publishing later this week and next week too. All in all, I think it ultimately came down to who was able to deliver the visions and lead the way in their own individual fields and their own sectors. So, I mean, you're right, Andrew, in terms of trying to devise a lift, it's super tough and it's a hard thing to pin down in the sense of power and how it's used positively and progressively. So in their own roles, of course, and these individuals, it's hard to weigh up, but we've done the list and here it goes.
Now, we've limited this just to 25, which is a purely arbitrary number in terms of there are many names that could be on the cusp of this list but didn't quite make it. So this is your chance to mention them and maybe save yourself some awkward conversations in Berlin. So who do you see as the nearly men and women?
Well, I mean, there are so many. The initial list was somewhere in the region of 80, 85. We had to condense it down to 25. Super tough to do. I mean, just a few names. Obviously, there are team principals who are not on the list who do have power in their own right. James Barclay, in particular. Gerd Mauser, of course, who is the chairman of Jaguar Racing. Michael Andretti. I mean, you know, what a glittering career he had as a driver and now as a team owner. And his power will only increase as they go separate ways after the BMW era there. Mark Preston from DS Techita, obviously hugely successful proponent of all things EV as well. The technical side, Craig Wilson from Williams Advanced Engineering, who's been crucial in the Gen 1 batteries and now looking after the Gen 3 iteration of batteries to be used in the next rule set. Laurent Arnault, who is the technical delegate for the FIA, has a certain degree of power from a regulatory point of view. Alessandra Chiliberti, who is the project manager for the Gen 3 project, doesn't feature in this list, but will be documented in future content next week. You know, we could go on a few more people from Formula E. Ollie McCrudden, City's development director, who I know you know well, Andrew. Roger Hooker, who is the event operations director, who is integral to putting these events on in Formula E. Manolo Ortiz Trello, who was one of the first employees of Alejandro Agag back in 2012, I believe, or maybe just 2013, when he was appointed to try and get these events on. There are new names also. Henry Chilcott, a new face in the paddock, the chief brand officer who has been recruited from McLaren. I mean, a few ones that I know reasonably well. Carlo Vigors, who is Porsche's eye-twinkling, sharp commercial business and partnerships manager, who's a really, really engaging character in Formula E. Aurora, Lawrence Duffy, the founder of Aurora, who bring the TV content, doesn't feature. That it's been brought largely in-house now. So Sebastian Tiffert, who is in charge of the content to a large degree there. Yeah, many, many more. But there's just some of the people who didn't quite make the cut, but certainly do have a lot of power and influence in Formula E.
Now, there's one name that people will probably be expecting to see figure prominently, and that's Jean Todt. Yet we made a conscious decision not to include the FIA president. Can you briefly explain why?
So we looked at this very carefully and decided that President Todd's power was, I suppose, so all-encompassing, ubiquitous, that really in the case of Formula E, it just stands alone. So, as it does in many other spheres of the sport, of course. So, of course, you have to recognise that ultimately Formula E is his baby, which he so often states that it is. And without him, the fact is that Formula E would not have happened the way it has. And he has to take so much credit for that. But ultimately, this kind of feature shouldn't probably include such powerful entities who have such a wide range of influence in world motorsport. So I think Formula E in itself is really interesting how it was born and how it formed. Jean Todt is an integral part of that, and you know, his contribution and his massive influence again will be reflected in some supplementary content pieces next week.
Great. So let's start the countdown, which in classic chart fashion, we're going to do in reverse order. So first of all, we're going to look at those in places 25 to 16. So I'm not going to go a new entry at number what X on all of these, because that will end up being quite tedious. But in at 25 is Arti Dabas, who's the chief media officer at Formula E. Can you just explain a little bit about her role there?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, Arti Dabas, a Harvard graduate. She joined Formula E early in 2020 as one of Jamie Riegel, the new CEO's key hires. She oversaw a lot of growth in the ICC, the International Cricket Council, and had a long career there. She's had recent success with deals with Star India and the British terrestrial coverage in Channel 4. And she wields quite a lot of power in terms of all media, but specifically the TV broadcast deals that that we're seeing now.
Talking of media, so a friend of this show at 24 is Dario Franchitti.
Yeah, well, I mean, Dario doesn't need any introduction, does he? Legendary presence in motorsport, particularly over in the States, of course. I mean, he does things so well in terms of presenting, and I kind of think of him myself as the Formula E's Martin Brundle. Very engaging, educates, informs, and does it in a way that isn't just specialised. He can make people coming who are new to Formula E understand what it's all about. When he speaks, you listen. Because he's got so much experience and so just so erudite in the way that he comes across. And I think in terms of his power, it's very much a communicating presence to the eyes and ears that are tuning in on TV.
Yeah, I think he's done a really good job of making people understand how the power conservation and lift and coast and the role of the driver. And like you say, you can't underestimate the influence that has with the watching public. In 23, we've got Hannah Brown, who is a Chief Strategy and Business Development Manager at Formula E.
Yeah, that's right. Another new recruit. She came at a similar time to Arti Dabas, the early part of 2020. Very successful career in sports business and media development, particularly at Sky Sports. And she was also on the advisory board of the Drone Racing League. She's got a really wide-ranging remit, which includes communications, human resources, and sustainability. So I think her influence will only grow in Formula E and across several departments under Jamie Riegel's CEO-ship.
Another friend of the show in 22 is Dilbag Gill, who, as well as being the team principal at Mahindra, is also on the ENEC board.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Dilbag, a great, great character, terrific face of the sport, engaging, emotional, and effective as a team principal. The most recent winner of a Formula E race, of course, with Alex Lynn in London. I think Dilbag's power, he uses it very, very intelligently. Mahindra, I think a lot of people are not really fully abreast of just how big Mahindra are globally. So they often sometimes can get lost with some of the bigger, more higher profile, shall we say, in terms of motorsport OEMs. But nonetheless, Dilbag has good political nous, and he was a chair of the Formula E Teams and Manufacturers Association, and as you mentioned, is now on the board of the Electric and New Energies Championship Commission, which does inform some of the future technical roadmap of Formula E.
Somebody that we've both worked with extensively in 21st, and that's Frederick Espinos, who is currently the Formula E Sporting Director.
Yeah, another great character of Formula E. He's been there since the start. Interesting story in the fact that he was literally born into the sport when his mother, Michelle Biche Espinos, was competing in the Monte Carlo Rally while she was pregnant as a co-driver in the 70s. So yeah, he's had a long career in the media. Particularly, he was a media officer for many years. First met him about a decade ago when he worked for SRO. He got into the sort of event and sporting side of things initially with Formula 3, and then came to Formula E when it started in 2014. He's got a really influential role. He often jokes that he makes the teams and drivers' lives a misery, but he does juggle multiple sporting topics with a really strong affability.
A lot of the people on this list will maybe be faces that people aren't familiar with, but in 20 is a very familiar face to motorsport fans, and that's Susie Wolf, who is the Rocket Venturi team principal and also the co-founder of Girls on Track.
Yeah, that's right. I think Susie's racing career has been well profiled, certainly. In terms of Formula E, she came in 2018 as the team principal for Venturi, which was she immediately put into a more accelerated state of transition. They won their first race while she was team principal in Hong Kong with Eduardo Mortara. Of course, she also has a stake in Venturi. She's presided over three full campaigns now, hired Jerome D'Ambrosio, which was a smart move. And as you mentioned, the Girls on Track initiative, which Susie promotes wholeheartedly along with the FIA and Formula E. They were in London doing some great work as well. Yeah, high profile. She certainly is profiled in media a great deal, and overall is a strong presence for Formula E.
In 19, we've got Sylvain Filippi, who's the managing director and CTO of Envision Virgin Racing, but he's also the FATAMA chairman.
Yeah, very well-informed, passionate electric mobility advocate, Sylvain. Again, been in Formula E since the start and has worked his way up to managing director status with Envision Virgin, as it's now known. His role, his chairmanship of FATAMA is the key one, which got him into this position, I think. It's an interesting position. It's one that sees the chair often have to be quite combative with the FIA and Formula E. And I think from what I hear and what we know, he's doing a good job at FATAMA. It's kind of thrust him into the realms of some paddock politics, which I'm not sure is his sort of natural domain. I mean, he's again, a terrifically affable guy, but he's no pushover, and I think that's reflected in the success of the team over the years.
You just explained to listeners exactly what FATAMA is, because it's gone through a few different guises and grown in the way that it's worked over the years.
Yeah, it's an association which includes the teams and the manufacturers to look after a whole host of issues that can crop up from time to time. I mean, similar associations have existed in pretty much all other professional racing disciplines, and they cycle the chairmanship over a couple of years. So the previous ones have been, as I mentioned, Dilbert Gill and Roger Griffiths. So they're really out to they're not out to do anything. What they're there for is to make sure that the teams and that the manufacturers are heard on a sporting, technical, political basis. Really from race to race.
Next is Mike Papadimitriou, who unsurprisingly is known as Mike Papa inside Formula E, where he is the chief financial officer.
Yeah, that's right. He joined the company in August 2015 at the behest of Discovery, who took a major shareholding in Formula E earlier that year. He's got several roles, actually. He's got some executive power, obviously, in financial and strategic matters. But I think it probably goes a bit deeper than that. He's the kind of person who is very he's sort of stitched into the fabric of Formula E now in terms of what he does and his role in the sort of C-suites area of the business. And he's quite unique in the sense that, he wasn't an AGAG hire, and he wasn't a Jamie Regal hire. He was hired by Discovery when they came in. So I think he's got a really good perspective of where the power lies and how things are done at an executive level. So I think certainly most chief financial officers have a degree of power in any business, but in something like this, which is evolved from a startup into a much bigger sporting entity, I think certainly he deserves his place in this top 25.
For scholars of motorsport, the next name on this list will be one that they're instantly familiar with, but one that maybe they haven't heard for a little while. And that's Julian Jacoby, who was the chairman of GP Sports Management and somebody who is absolutely now in the DNA of that series.
Yes, he is a legendary figure. Celebrated his 70th birthday early this year, but he's still hard at it. His roles in the careers of Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost and many others are well known. But in Formula E, they currently have 7 drivers in the championship through the GP Sports Management Company, which he runs and employs along with his son, Alexander Jacoby, who's going to be featured in the under-40s part of this power list. I think in terms of power, it's very deceptive. You know, people sometimes assume that he is just a driver representative, but he has... He has lots of tentacles reaching out to teams and partners and beyond. And I think his fingers consistently on the pulse in the paddock, and his relationships with some of the key stakeholders are absolutely key to how some of the machinations and the politics of the paddock work.
The final name in this first part of the rundown is unlikely to be one that most people are familiar with, and that's Li Zhang, who is the founder and president of Envision Energy.
Yeah, I met and spoke to Li Zhang in Sanya a couple of years ago. Very interesting character. He was the founder of Envision Energy, which is a wind power tech engineering company, and a huge one, not just in China, globally. And he bought the majority stake in the Virgin Racing operation through his holding company, which is Move Group Topco. It spawned a new team in Envision Virgin Racing in name, really. It was the essence of the team was pretty secure. And really what it did is it gave him and Envision Energy a platform to market themselves, to be better known, of course. And it also gave the existing Virgin team, or the erstwhile Virgin team, something that a basis, a solid foundation, because I think the Virgin aspect of that team was sort of yawing a bit in certain times during the middle portion of Formula E's history. But the name has been kept there. He rarely attends races. His vice president Franz Jung, who is the chairman of the board at EVR, effectively has day-to-day control. But, you know, again, at 16, I only see Li Zhang probably becoming more and more powerful as the seasons go on.
Sam, we'll notice that there aren't any Formula E drivers that are featured on this list, but you caught up with one of the many that are still in the chance of taking the inaugural Formula E World Championship title this weekend, and that's Mercedes EQ Stoffel van Dorn, to discuss how drivers are able to use power and influence in Formula E.
I guess as a driver, we have quite a lot of influence, let's say, within the team, because we're kind of the main driver behind a lot of decisions on setup, because we're the drivers that feel everything that happens in the car, things that we require from the car to be able to extract everything. So we're kind of the main driver, or giving the main information to the engineers for them to make a good change, for us to feel comfortable. And that has a big influence on the overall team result in the end, whether it's, setup changes, but even organization-wise within the team. You know, sometimes us drivers have an influence on engineering, on strategy people, how the team is working together, because we've had previous experiences. So I think when people have experience and they've been working with different teams in their career, they can always bring something extra to the teams and improve them.
You mentioned that connection between yourself and your engineer, which is obviously vital, but
another piece of the puzzle, which is always vital in Formula E, is the driver in the loop simulator, which you spend a lot of your time in. Can a driver maximize his influence greatly here in the way that he works in the sim, preparing for these really concertina tight time frames of events at Formula E races?
Yeah, I think the simulator is actually one of the tools that is mainly used by all the teams before we go to any event. So a lot of work has been done before we even turn up at the circuit. Usually that's 2-3 days of work, I would say, before we really hit the real circuit. And it is very important in Formula E because it's such a short event. We only have one day with 2-3 practices, a qualifying session, and then immediately into the race. So there's not really any time when you arrive to just discover things and get used to things. You really need to arrive prepared, and that's why so much work has been done in the simulator beforehand. For us drivers as well, a lot of circuits, they're new when we go to them. For example, London, the last race was a complete new circuit for everybody, and the simulator was a really useful tool for us drivers to get ready, to know which direction the circuit is turning, but then also for the teams to prepare their setups, to prepare the energy management systems. Really 95% of the job is being done in the simulator before we even turn up at the circuit.
And away from the cockpit, Stoffel, what are the dynamics like in Formula E? Can a driver exert their assertiveness or their power just like any other championship? And how do you do that positively within a team?
I guess being a leader within the team is something that the teams always appreciate. Like I kind of said before, we're kind of the main drivers in the team that give a direction to the team to develop a car, to give them a direction on setup, but also to give the confidence to the people you're working with. I think it's very important to have a good team dynamic, to have a really good relationship with your engineer, your mechanics, and really, make them feel one team, basically. Usually, one of my routines before the race is to spend some time with my mechanics, kind of just casually laughing. And that's also how I feel like I can relax a little bit before the race, not taking too much pressure on board. So I think it's very important for the overall team result.
And Stoffel, I remember earlier this year you did a demonstration run of your Mercedes EQ Silver Arrow 02 along that spectacular Magna Road in Neom, which is going to be this remarkable, sustainable, smart community of the future, which has been built on the Red Sea. Tell us about that experience, because if the photos or the film had anything to go by, it looked very spectacular.
Yeah, this really was an incredible experience. It was obviously the first time I went to visit Neom. Quite a long way to get there in Saudi Arabia, but once I got there, it was really a super, super beautiful place. It was nice to see the base camp where all the preparation work is going on, and to see all the plans of what the future city of Neom is going to look like. And then obviously I had a very unique chance to drive my car on the Magna Road, which was incredible, an incredible location, amazing scenery, great to spend a little bit of time with the people of Neom, explaining us about the history and especially explaining about the future, what the target of Neom is. So an incredible experience, and really I can't wait to go back there in a couple of years and see how Neom is developing, and hopefully together with Mercedes we'll have a little bit of an influence on the development of Neom as well.
Well, that was some excellent insight from Stoffel there. Next up, we're looking at the people who figure in positions 15 to 11. Starting at 15, I'm going to have to take a deep breath so I don't get this wrong, is His Royal Highness Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal Al Saud, And Sam, you can explain what his role is.
Yeah, he's an extremely powerful man, a member of the House of Saud and the appointed Minister of Sports in Saudi Arabia, covers all of motorsport in and around the Gulf as well, works alongside pretty closely with Carlo Buttaghi, who we both know, who was instrumental in bringing Formula E to Saudi Arabia in 2018, and massive achievement to get that project pushed forward by a year. And obviously there's natural power in being a member of the Royal House, and all that entails, but he's also a true enthusiast of the sport and has competed in many disciplines, largely between sort of 2004 and 2015. He actually has got 6 Le Mans under his belt, so he was certainly no slouch when it came to racing, and scored 4 top 10 finishes in the LMGTE class at Le Mans.
And 14th, we've got Tommaso Volpe, who is the Global Motorsport Director at Nissan.
Yeah, Volpe came in to replace Mike Carcamo, who went on to other things within Nissan. And Volpe, largely a marketing background in automotive, but one who came to Nissan after their first season, which had been a contentious one with the infamous Twin MGU Challenger that year, and sort of had to pick up some of the pieces from that. Again, a very affable individual, very as an assertive manner though, and lots of people who have been at the sporting working groups and the some of the high level meetings that are in Formula E have noted that. I think he is there to affirm, obviously, Nissan's best interests in many areas, and particularly I've caught up with him on a few occasions, and he's taken a great interest in the technical roadmap and a lot of the clarity that is starting to come now from the cost cap plans for 2023 and beyond.
It's another former guest on this show in 13, and that's Scott Elkins, who's the FIA Formula E race director.
Yeah, you don't get much more powerful jobs, do you, than trying to control 24 adrenaline-fueled drivers for 45 minutes in a lap. But that's Scott's job, and he's done it since 2017. I think he does a pretty remarkable job of it. He's very engaging, an engaging Californian. He has the respect of the paddock and a lot of the drivers. You know, it's very rare that anyone openly criticizes him. His door's always open, and for somebody in such a powerful position, I think that's pretty commendable. It's the way that he operates. His power during track time is obvious, and I think what isn't seen as much is the work he does on safety and track infrastructure as well. He's also involved in Extreme E now. He's the race director in Extreme E, so he's got a lot on his plate, but he's able to juggle it. He's a good delegator, and he's, you know, it's something that he's learned. We talked about this, didn't we, last year, that he'd learnt quite a lot from his, I suppose, his unofficial mentor, the late Charlie Whiting.
In 12 is someone I've known for best part of 20 years, who was a very fresh-faced young engineer at ASM at the time, but is now the chief engineer at Spark Racing Technologies, and that's Theo Guzan.
Yeah, that's right. From a engineering technical perspective, certainly one of the most powerful around. Without him, it simply wouldn't happen. And in his team, of course, there works with a big team now at SRT. Led the design teams on all 3 iterations of the projects, was integral to the Extreme E project, also a sort of a linchpin of what goes on technically in Formula E. As you mentioned, began his career at ASM, which became ART, had a spell at Oak Racing, but then joined Spark in 2012 at the behest of Fred Vasseur. Excellent technical leadership, has got a really close relationship with the FIA, and again, a bit like Scott Elkins, appears to have the universal respect of everyone in the paddock.
And completing this rundown in 11 is Sheng Li, who's also a formerly stakeholder as well as the owner of DS Techeetah.
Yeah, intriguing character, Sheng Li, founder of Seeker, which is a large marketing agency based in Shanghai. It's itself owned by China Media Capital and has been involved in Formula E since 2016, when he effectively bought the Team Aguri slot. Not massively hands-on. He has several trusty lieutenants who do that for him. At the same time as he bought, or a similar time that he bought into Formula E via a team, he also did that got a stake, a minority stake in Formula E Holdings as well. So he's got a natural power, a sort of dual pronged power. The success of the team's been evident on track with those three drivers' titles and two teams' titles as well. But it hasn't all been plain sailing. There's been this undercurrent of instability somehow in the team. That could be resolved soon, we think, by a potential sale of the team. But we've got to wait for that to happen a bit later this year, I think.
This year marks the debut of Formula E as an official world championship, something that in part only became possible because of the influx of manufacturers into the sport. When the likes of Porsche, Jaguar, BMW and Mercedes joined, there was a worry that they would become too powerful. To understand how and where manufacturers can exert their influence, Sam's spoken to Ian James, who's the team principal of Mercedes EQ.
So, Ian, we've been talking about power and influence and how it's used positively in the paddock and in Formula E. And from your point of view, how crucial is it to make the key and correct decisions as a team principal while using a certain amount of that power and influence that you and TPs around the paddock have?
I think as team principals in our roles, we have a responsibility to keep an eye on the big picture. And when you talk about sort of using power and influence, I think, as you say, it needs to be done in a very collaborative way. And that's one of the key things that I've been pleased to see during my time in Formula E, is the fact that because it's a startup series, I mean, we're in our seventh season at the moment, we're still sort of forming the series as a whole and making sure that it's set up well for the future. And I think what we try to do is we try to take a look at what the key objectives are and then as a group work towards those objectives. So the TP role is very much then aligned with the other parts of the organisation, whether that be with FEO or with the FIA. And I think it's crucial to really keep that dialogue going and keep it open. But from what I've observed so far, it's we've managed to do that to a greater or lesser extent.
It's well known in Formula E just how tight and marginal the competition is. I mean, we're heading into the Berlin weekend this weekend with practically three quarters of the grid up for the title. When the sporting and technical margins are that fine, does it help from a management perspective to empower all of the team to some degree? And how do you do that?
As you know, the teams themselves, the operational team within Formula E, are quite small, certainly in relation to other motorsport series. And that's done deliberately. It keeps things compact. It's done with an eye on sustainability, both from an environmental perspective and from a cost perspective as well. But what it does mean is that there's a huge amount of responsibility on each one of those team members. Now, each one is, you know, that they have an incredible amount of expertise in their chosen field. But at the same time, because of the small size of the teams, they also need to have an understanding of the roles that they interact with. And for that reason, you're able to empower them, they're able to take decisions themselves. And that helps as well. If you take a look at the format of Formula E, the race, for example, it's only 45 minutes plus one lap in duration. There's an incredible amount going on during that time. And it simply wouldn't be possible for one or two individuals then to have that overview and to take the key strategic decisions. So in terms of empowerment, whether it be the race engineers that are liaising directly with the drivers, the strategy engineer who's taking a look at the overall strategy of the race, a couple of the other key roles that we have in the team, each one of those individuals needs to be able to take decisions really within a split second. And to delegate that or to delegate it upwards, if you like, just simply wouldn't be possible. Now, what that means for my own role is that I have the luxury, I suppose, of keeping an overview of things. And it's only on very rare occasions then where maybe there's a different perspective that's needed, or you can sort of throw in a different question just to take a look at things in a different way, that comes into play as well. But no, very lucky to have a huge amount of experience in the team and very easy, therefore, to entrust the people with that level of responsibility and decision-making.
Now, structuring and working proactively within the team is one thing, but another part of your job, obviously, is working with the promoters, other teams, the governing body also. How do you use power and influence in a positive manner from that perspective? Because it can occasionally get quite tricky, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we spoke about it a minute ago about that collaboration between not only the teams and manufacturers, but the FIA and FEO. And I think it's absolutely crucial that we have an understanding of what the common goals are in that respect. The fact that we are still in this sort of startup phase, the fact that we are still discussing what the future of the series should look like and how we can really drive it to realize its full potential. It's important that dialogue keeps going and that it's open. Now, there are several different elements to that. Racing is obviously the number one priority, without a doubt. That needs to be competitive. It needs to be close racing. We need to be able to put on a show for the fans as well. Ultimately, that's absolutely key. But there are other elements as well that I think that need to be looked after. We often talk about the DNA of the championship, the fact that we are racing in these city centres, which is pretty much unique to Formula E, and really the fact that we're fully electric allows that. So that I see as a crucial topic going forward. Sustainability is another one which lies at the heart of Formula E, and it's something where it's not only good enough to talk about it, you need to walk the talk as well, as they say. You need to make sure that we're implementing the improvements going forward to make sure that we're relevant in that area as well. And as I say, that power and influence you talk about, I think that needs to be used in a positive way. So it's important every so often to take a step back, to look at where we're at, and look at where we need to be in the future and ask the question, are we moving in the right direction? And if not, having the courage to correct the course. As you say, that we're not always going to be in agreement on those topics, and there are things that need to be balanced, whether those are sporting, technical or commercial topics. But keeping that dialogue there and being able, if you believe in something enough, being able then to debate it and in that way you use your influence to move it in the direction that you think it needs, in which you think it needs to go, I think is of crucial importance. But again, it's that balance between having an opinion and driving in that direction, but also being ready to listen to the opinions of others at the same time and coming up with a balanced view at the end of the day.
Right, now we're into the really big hitters. Here are those in positions 10 to 6. In 10th, we've got Javier Mestolón-Pignon, who is the FIA technical director.
Yeah, he's the FIA's big new recruit, joined earlier this year, well-known in the Formula E paddock, having been in it from the second season onwards with as DS Performance's director. Ex-MP, as he's known, much easier for everybody, he's had a long career with PSA, the former PSA, now part of this merger with Fiat Chrysler, and has become this Stellantis behemoth. There's much more to this sort of poacher term gamekeeper scenario though with XMP, and I think he's taken over from Gilles Simon, who was a very influential technical head at the FIA. He's going to have a great deal of influence on and power on where things go in the technical roadmap in the future. Of course, that's going to take in a new president of the FIA as well. So there's going to have to be a decent blending pretty quickly into that relationship to make sure that Gen 4 and beyond of Formula E is going in the right direction. So yeah, a great deal of overarching power from a motorsport and ultimately an electric mobility point of view.
In 9th, we've got Frédéric Bertrand, who again works for the FIA, and he's the FIA's Formula E and Innovative Sports Activities man.
Yeah, Frédéric has been an ever-present since day one, pretty much. First as the director of FIA Circuit Championships. Sorry, I'll start that again. Yeah, Fred has been pretty much an ever-present in Formula E since day one, first as the director of FIA Circuit Championships and now the director of Innovative Sport Activities. He's well versed in lots of areas in motorsport, particularly sports business, motorsport business development, and how the industry works as a whole. he's almost a decade into his career now with the FIA, and he's accrued power alongside or working for President Todd, has a great deal to say on the sporting and technical structure of Formula E, particularly the sporting, which, let's not beat around the bush, that has come in for some criticism this season alone, but actually the innovation and the flexibility that he has allowed in Formula 3, I think the bigger picture should probably be applauded. But, you know, there's certainly obviously some work to do as it develops as a world championship. He had to deal with some big topics this season, notably the Valencia energy crisis. But, you know, to be fair to him, he stood up and was counted and fronted up to the media on that occasion and gave some answers.
I don't think you can underestimate how crucial that role is in balancing, because the original Formula E people wanted to go completely out there with sporting regulations, and as we know, the FIA can be quite a conservative organisation, and being able to balance both of those pieces and get into a happy medium is a real achievement. So kudos to that. In eight, we've got Thierry Bellor, who is the chairman of Jaguar Land Rover.
Yeah, an automotive industry big hitter since he joined Renault in 2012. Bellor is still only a few months into his, or just less than a year actually, into his role as CEO of Jaguar Land Rover, and he joined at a really crucial time. They've had this strategy now called the Reimagine Epoch, which is a sort of defining all electric program for Jaguar Land Rover and its products in the next the next sort of 20 years. They want to have a net zero status across supply chains, operators and products by 2039. So a huge statement of where they're going. It preceded a commitment to Gen 3, and there's been lots of good news for Jaguar in terms of confirming that, renewing their relationship with technical partners Williams Advanced Engineering, the re-signing of Mitch Evans, which came a couple of weeks ago. He won't be a regular visitor to the paddock, but in terms of power, you know, he's the man ultimately who says yes or no on the really big decisions. But structurally, Jaguar's got a really strong structure in place, I think, there, obviously, with Gerd Mauser, with James Barkley, Gary Eckelrold, obviously, is there as well. And we've already talked a little bit about Craig Wilson and Williams Advanced Engineering.
Next up is Carlos Tavares, who's the chief executive officer of Stellantis, which, for people who aren't familiar with the name, is the company that was created when Fiat Chrysler and the PSA Group merged. I think was earlier this year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It sort of spread from 2020 to 21, but was confirmed earlier this year. Yeah, Tavares, one of the higher profile of the kingpins in automotive, but crucially for Stellantis and its brands, a huge racing fan. That's never really clouded his judgment on decisions on motorsport programs, and obviously that filters down to some of the managers and the vice presidents. Example being Jean-Marc Fino, who we see in the paddock much more than Tavares. But what I like about Tavares is that he competes himself. So he's got a Rolt RT3, and he's got a Lola T70 Mark 3B, which obviously, you know, makes him a bit of a superhero, doesn't it? Having a Lola T70. So he's got the fever, he's got the passion. Super high executive though, massive amount of power. And when you represent so many brands, it just makes him super, super influential. The big sort of topic in terms of newsy things happening in Formula E is whether a second Stellantis brand will come in. There's been a lot of talk. There was a lot of talk earlier in the year about Alfa Romeo. They've committed to Formula One. There's a lot of questions now about Maserati, and will Maserati come in at some stage during Gen 3? We know DS is staying, but it's up to Tavares and then the likes of Jean-Marc Fina, who's the senior vice president of Stellantis Motorsport, to make these key decisions.
And six is a name that all Formula One fans will be familiar with, but maybe not so much in Formula E, and that's Toto Wolff, who's the director of Mercedes-Benz Formula E Limited.
Yeah, that's right. There's a bit of a misnomer that Toto Wolff, you know, doesn't come to races or doesn't take a keen interest. That's absolutely not the truth. He's only missed two races this year, I believe. So he's been at the majority of them. He's the director of the holding company of Mercedes EQ, which is Mercedes-Benz Formula E Limited. He has the power, the ultimate power there, but day-to-day management has been taken by Ian James, who's doing a really good job, and they've had a lot of success already. There is a black cloud hanging over the Mercedes future commitment with Gen 3. We believe that's going to be either confirmed or confirmed that they're not going to do that in the coming weeks. That apart, I think it should be resolved shortly, but the question then is going to be what happens. Is there going to be a plan B? Is there going to be a lifeboat for the team? And is there going to be a Mercedes, not a Mercedes team, but something that evolves from that that organization? But yeah, Toto Wolff, obviously synonymous with his role in Formula One, but certainly in Formula E terms, does have a great deal of power.
Well, now we're delighted to be joined by Neil Copeland, Partnership Director at NEOM. NEOM are a principal partner of the Mercedes EQ Formula E team, having signed with the team in February 2020, and are the presenting partner of the 2021 Formula E Power List. For those of you unaware of the NEOM project, it's a region being developed on the banks of the Red Sea in northwest Saudi Arabia. NEOM's purpose is to provide the world with a vision of a new future, providing fresh thinking and new solutions to global challenges. Over time, NEOM become a destination and a home for over a million people from around the world, with exceptional livability, thriving commerce, all underpinned by a commitment to build a more sustainable future. Now, Neil, we've seen across the board, but particularly in motorsport, Saudi Arabia investing a lot in sport. Why is that?
Yeah, I think sport is a tremendously important lever to be able to promote the region to the rest of the world. There's a massive amount of progress being made in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf economically. It's an area with tremendous heritage and a rich culture, and sport is no better way to show off that to people in all parts of the globe. So it's nothing unusual. You know, we see that all the time through other sporting events, and no more recent than the Tokyo Olympics. You know, it's a fine way to show off the capabilities of a nation, and also to show off the hospitality of the people that are there, and also the amazing sights and scenes that are also available to people. So, you know, Saudi Arabia does that very, very well. It's done that through a number of sports. Not what better way to see the beautiful, pristine mountains and deserts through the Dakar Rally, or to see the lights and nights of Diriyah through the Formula E, or the streets of Jeddah through Formula One. So, it's a perfect way to show off exactly what these amazing assets are.
We mentioned in the intro that NEOM is a partner of Mercedes and is involved in Formula E. How does Formula E fit in with the overall vision for NEOM?
Yeah, I mean, NEOM's vision is very clear. We have to address some of the major issues that are facing the planet at the moment. How are we going to live in the 22nd century, and how soon can we start that living in the 21st century? So we've got to address climate change. We've got to address the environment. We've got to look at some of the biological issues that we're seeing at the moment. We need to be far more sustainable than we've ever been before. We need to find out how technology and innovation can help us in that journey and advances, but we also need to learn how we can live with the natural environment as we used to do previously without damaging it. So therefore, you know, the NEOM project needs all the sectors that we rely on in our everyday lives to develop in such a way that we can make those progressions and advancements. So mobility is a key one, and Formula E being at the forefront of electric vehicle development, and again highlighting how that can have an impact on inner cities or lessen the impact to cities, is absolutely, you know, key for us. And there's lots of key learnings that we can take from that. And Formula E in itself is incredibly exciting event to watch, and the fact that it's able to go into city centres and have minimal climatic impacts is a fabulous connection for us as a project.
And many of us would have seen those terrible sights from Greece, with people fleeing these islands that are on fire, and the awareness around the climate crisis at the moment is probably as high as it's ever been. What role can sport play in helping to make people more aware of what they can do?
Yeah, I think sport plays a massive role in a number of ways, and I think the social conscience of the athletes who participate in sport at the highest level. Lewis Hamilton is a good example of this. Other athletes in the Olympics the same, and they can bring and draw to attention and change an agenda now in a way that probably they couldn't 20 years ago. You know, we used to kind of see players in football hiding a message under their jersey and lifting it up if they scored a goal, and that might get, you know, a few seconds of media coverage. But now, you know, through social media, they can have a very serious impact on some of the key issues, and whether that's about the environment or other issues of the day, then they can bring that to the fore. And that's a great way of getting messages across, because people like to engage with sport and they can do that. So that's one element to it. The second element is that sport brings together a more cohesive society. I mean, again, there's nothing new in that aspect. And where we can play sports as communities, it brings people together. It takes away a lot of other issues that might exist within, particularly within urban areas, whether that's with young people's behaviour or drug addiction, etc. It can certainly address those things. But it brings a no end of health benefits to get involved in sporting activities. And for the livability in a region. So livability within NEOM is a key factor and a key draw card for wanting people from around the planet to come and live in NEOM. And our livability is going to be of extremely high standard, and sport is going to play a huge role in being able to deliver that.
I was there for the first Formula E race in Diriyah. It was a part of the world I'd never been to before, and I wasn't really sure what to expect, but there was... Well, it rained for a start, which I definitely wasn't expecting. But there was a big turnout there as well, because there was obviously that concert that was playing on the evening. How have you seen Formula E's fan base growing in Saudi Arabia, and what do you perceive as the potential for it?
Yeah, I think I mean, that was, you know, a historic occasion to host that race in 2018, to see young Saudis, boys and girls, men and women, you know, dancing together at the concert, enjoying the race. You know, it was certainly a huge progression. And that progression has continued year on year at a huge rate as well. And you know, Formula E as a fabulous spectacle within the cities is a massive way of being able to achieve that. And people are incredibly excited about it and watching it. And it can help us change our concepts around mobility as well. But it also helps change around lifestyle. People like to attend events, and we, you know, very much hope that NEOM will be able to host a Formula E race in the not too distant future. So that's something that we'll be looking closely at, and you know, hopefully one day we'll have a race here as well.
How important to you is the participation? Obviously there hasn't been a top line Saudi Arabian driver, but is it something that you'd like to inspire?
Yeah, definitely, very much so. I think that one of the major objectives around the Mercedes partnership with the Mercedes EQ Formula E team is to entice new young talent, and that goes right across the board. So that's not just about racing talent, that's about talent that exists within Saudi Arabia, maybe for the next generation of engineers, software developers, marketeers, event managers, you know, media. So we have opportunities for our young graduates to go over with Mercedes and learn and take on roles in the UK and bring all that expertise and that passion for winning and that culture back to the kingdom and back to NEOM. But at the same time, yes, you know, we're going to put a driver development program in place, and we're going to provide some aspirations for young Saudis, boys and girls, to get involved in electric vehicle racing, and you know, if we want them to pursue that. And I think inevitably, the wider the net, the more dedicated the coaching and the more ambitious the programs, inevitably you will drop out some world champions at some stage in the future.
Excellent stuff. Is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, no, only to say, obviously, the NEOM with Mercedes is you know, a project that really helps us develop our brand as one of the biggest brands in the planet. I think number 8 in the world. To rub shoulders with Mercedes is a positive for NEOM to help develop. It's good for our mobility, as we've talked about. It's great for the talent development and for our thought leaders, and good for sport. So we feel it's got a really good mix right across the whole of the NEOM project, and something that will certainly help us move a lot quicker in achieving our ambitions. And so far, you know, we've been really delighted with the things that we've seen from Mercedes and the Formula E team. You know, their successes we've enjoyed, and we hope that there's many more to come in the future.
Well, they go into this weekend in contention with both drivers for the Drivers' Championship and the Teams' Championships, but it's been such a roller coaster of a season, from some glorious highs and from some low lows. You know, do you know, have you got half an inkling of what to expect from what's going to happen in Tempelhof?
I've never failed to see a Mercedes driver on the podium for the races that I've attended, and I'm going to both at the weekend. So there you go. That's my prediction.
Oh, well, if they got the lucky charm in tow, then what could possibly go wrong? Okay, now we're into the extremely rarefied heights of power, the top five. So bringing that to a start is Fritz Engsinger, who's the head of motorsport at Porsche AG and the head of Volkswagen Group Motorsport.
Yeah, Engsinger's an interesting personality. Relatively quiet, actually. He does sort of seem to be in the background at some of the races, but he headed up the phenomenal 919 LMP1 hybrid program that won so much at Le Mans and in the World Endurance Championship. Prior to that, he had a long career at BMW, where he was part of that BMW F1 engine testing program before they hooked up with Williams. Since that time, he's gone through the ranks of Porsche to become the vice president of motorsport. And he also has a similar role at Volkswagen Group Motorsport, which has ceased the majority of its motorsport programs, but does still exist. His power within both of these big roles is really significant. So a top five position was a bit of a no-brainer, really. And I think the fact that the Stuttgart Mark committed so early to Gen 3 really was a lot of the vision of Engsinger in terms of making that happen.
At number four, we've got a name that the lack of familiarity that most people will have with it will belie the nature of the power that's held, and that's Bjørn Rosengren, who is the president and chief executive officer of ABB.
Yeah, that's right. Rosengren took over from Ulrich Spieshofer, who departed in 2019. Rosengren came from a long career at Sandvik AB, which is a mineral mining company, technology company in Sweden. ABB's commitment to Formula E is pretty profound and has gone through, had a long-term deal. We believe that was renewed. Obviously, it's a mutually beneficial deal. ABB gets global marketing coverage, and in its own words, is transforming society and industry to achieve a much more productive and sustainable future, which is exactly what Formula E is doing. So there's a real blend there. I'm not going to get all marketing gobbledygook and say synergy, but oh dear, I just have. But you know what I mean. That kind of relationship at a high level. It's going to get quite interesting for both, because ABB is going to be heading into a more sporting angle in the future, because we do know that they are going to be an integral part of the technical and sporting structure when it comes to the planned fast charging infrastructure, which we believe is going to be part of Gen 3. So that's going to be really interesting to behold. And ABB's partnership with Formula E appears as strong as ever.
Yeah, I don't think you can underestimate that. What impact that fast charging will have on the cities as well. You know, this is where the legacy of Formula E will really start to come into play, when, you know, it leaves behind a way in which actually benefits the people who live in those places. Number three, Jamie Regal, who is the chief executive officer of Formula E itself.
Yeah, that's right. Ex-Manchester United FC and LA Rams NFL commercial high achiever. He joined Formula E in September 2019. Yes, that's correct. 2019. He has been a contrasting personality to Alejandro Agag, and I think, you know, that's plainly obvious. I think he's never pretended to be anything otherwise, and trying to follow in the footsteps of Agag as CEO, I think he's done exactly the right thing and not even tried to do that. But he had a lot of success with Manchester United, particularly in Asia. There's been ups and downs. Obviously, one of the key things has been it wasn't long into his tenure as CEO that the pandemic struck. So naturally, there's going to be a bit of a fracture in some of those plans. There's been success and some less successful appointments, shall we say. He's structured his own team and he's formed his own team and his nascent leadership so far. There was a peculiar, a bit of a worrying misunderstanding of what transpired in Valencia from a sporting point of view, I felt, from the CEO. I had a private conversation with him in the Valencia paddock after that happened, and you know that obviously stays private, but he then put a public message out on Instagram sort of calling it insinuating that it was great sort of energy management racing, which was a bit of a worry. But that apart, very very engaging individual, obviously extremely intelligent when it comes to commercial matters, and has a clear vision of where he believes Formula E is going. And actually, when somebody comes from outside the sport, they're often looked at skeptically. You remember, obviously, someone like Flavio Briatore in Formula One, completely different character, by the way, to Jamie Regal. But, you know, occasionally, even if initially things do great in terms of they don't quite seem to work, I think that people outside of the industry coming in, generally, there is a lot of benefit from fresh eyes seeing where a live sport entertainment business can go. And obviously, part of that is to try and monetize it, which Jamie is trying to do, and bringing in new recruits that are there to enable that.
Number two is Alberto Longo, who is the CCO of Formula E.
Yeah, Alberto, one of the most familiar faces in the paddock, somebody who's been imbued in it since the start, along with his business partner and cousin Alejandro Agag, a kind of talismanic figure when it comes to sporting and event organization and dealing with cities and the politics that go with that. I think his training in the sort of the legal profession has helped him achieve some of these incredible events that we see. It's not been plain sailing, though. I think the early days were so tough. I mean, let's not forget, as we mentioned earlier, the championship was within weeks, if not days, of not existing. And you know that well, Andrew, from 2014, early days of 2015. But I think it says much for both Agag and Longo that the axis survived and then kicked on, and then the foundations were laid with the buy-in of Liberty and Discovery. And I think Alberto is often referred to as the sporting leader, even though he is the deputy CEO, is the chief. He's a CEO, but he's also the deputy CEO of the championship. But I think just the fact that he has been involved in it from the start, from a sporting point of view, gives him a great deal of power. And I think the way that he deals with the partners and he deals with a lot of the stakeholders and most crucially and most actively with the cities where Formula E races, it seems to be pretty universal that, you know, he is the man who gets things done in the championship on that basis.
Yeah, he's also a formidable negotiator. He's often, you know, Alejandro would go in and charm them, and then Alberto comes in and does the dirty work, as it were, which leads us to number one. And I guess it's no surprise that Alejandro Agag, the chairman and founder of Formula E, occupies the top spot.
Yeah, I think when you look at the structure of Formula E, Alejandro is the chairman. Day to day, he doesn't have a great deal of influence, let's say, but what he does have is this this incredible charisma, and as you say, that the charm, which is when it's on the offensive, is seemingly you know, he's not able to be resisted by those that are within the room, let's say. I mean, he gets some of the most incredible deals done and some of the most remarkable projects completed. I think in Formula E terms, what he achieved there was pretty remarkable, from a shaky startup to then welcoming manufacturers in the space of, what, 3.5 years, pretty much. Was you know, you'll probably not see that in motorsport again. It was completely unique. Bringing it up to the modern day, obviously, as chairman, he still does come to the vast majority of races. I think he's only missed two, and one of those was I think both of them were COVID affected. I found it really interesting in Puebla this year, when in his own non-subtle way, but curiously engaging, using that charisma I mentioned, he kind of just reached out and via a TV camera brought across his self-confessed rage at the perceived injustice of Pascal Wehrlein losing his maiden Formula E win, and at the same time he apologised to the fans, which you don't get many heads of or chairmans or executives of championships fronting up and saying that. So I thought that was quite telling, and you know, a small thing, but again, something that tells you that actually, in terms of power and influence within a championship, he certainly got it. I think his headspace is taken up with Extreme E at the moment and what he's doing there. That's still in the stages of startup, but still, he always has an eye on his greatest professional achievement, which is, you know, which is Formula E. I think, you know, and I wrote this, that if Jean Todt, who often refers to Formula E as his growing infant, it was a baby, now it's a growing infant, a gag is the kind of tiger parent. He's the one pushing and pushing, hustling and at the same time aware of the power he wields and how it can be used at any given moment, but doing it with that, you know, with that charisma and charm. And that rubs off, you know, that when he walks down the pit lane or he walks down the back of the paddock, you know, he works it. He can work not a room, he can work an entire paddock. And I think it's intriguing at the moment, that style of doing things. And then you've got the more corporate ethos of Jamie Riegel. But, you know, if you were going to look at a possible ideal set up for a sporting entity, then, you know, you'd certainly want those ingredients within it. So, but in terms of being the number one, I don't think many will, you know, many will kick back against that. I think Gag, as the founder and as the chairman, he just has to be number one.
Well, thanks, Sam. Great work in pulling all this together. I'm sure many of our listeners are already formulating their own list now or questioning why certain people were in certain positions and so on. So please go to the-race.com where you can find the full power list, and you'll be able to leave your comments and questions below. And Sam and I will do our best to try to answer them. And also look out for those other articles that we've alluded to that Sam's written around the topic of power in Formula E that will be released over the next week or so. Once again, I'd like to thank Neom for their support. If you want to find out more about this incredible project, please visit neom.com. And of course, also subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, as over the next few weeks, we'll be looking back at the Berlin finale, talking about the champion and reviewing the season as a whole. Goodbye.